We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to our show one of our great friends of the program, the talented actor, author, and storyteller Stephen Tobolowsky, who joins us this afternoon through the magic of Skype. Well, how have you been?
I've been pretty good, considering. I mean, considering everything going around in Los Angeles. I don't know about Maine, but they keep opening and closing everything all the time. So you never really know. Now, you are able to go into some grocery stores without a mask, but others not. Restaurants, they expect you to go in with a mask and then take it off for some reason, like, because you got to eat. So it doesn't really matter. I don't know.
Yeah, we're masked up back here. We've had a little flare up around the States. So, yeah, we feel like we've gone back in time a bit.
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah. But otherwise, everything's fine. We had the Romeo and Juliet rehearsal yesterday, our first one. And it's really amazing.
That looks like such a wonderful show. Can you explain what the story of, let me see if I get it right here, Romeo and Juliet Senior Citizens Project.
Right. Yeah. The director, the fictitious director, just got his MFA from Yale Drama School, and he works for Uber Eats. But his first job he got is to work at the senior citizens home. So he wants to do a production of Romeo and Juliet with the senior citizens who are at the home. And so I play Romeo, and I'm a real estate guy who's had three marriages in my life. I served in Vietnam when I was a young man. And I'm playing Romeo. I have, a girlfriend at the home, Loretta, who was on One Life to Live, in her prime. She was an actress on One Life to Live. She played a person with 20 personalities, and seeing who she is in real life, she seems to come across that way. And then she expects she's going to play Juliet, but no. Who gets the role of Juliet is this little Asian woman who came in, and it's like, little did anyone know, it was the first love of my life. Wow. And I fell in love with her in high school, and her parents didn't like me, and my parents didn't like her, probably because she's Asian and I wasn't. Then I get sent to Vietnam. And I write her and tell her that I love her and miss her. And then I write her and say, will you marry me? And wow. I never get a response back. So I figure it's done. And she never got my letter. Just like in the play Romeo and Juliet.
Wow.
The message was not delivered. And so she ends up marrying. She has a life. I have a life. And now she walks into this senior citizens facility. Her husband has just passed away. And I see her, and it all comes back, and it all ignites, but it all comes through the play. It's amazing. And then we do the play Romeo and Juliet.
That sounds wonderful.
I mean, not the whole play.
All right. I still remember I played Montague a few years ago. Let's see.
Oh.
Many a morning have ye there been seen with tears augmenting the fresh morning's dew, adding to clouds more clouds with his deep sorrow. I can do that part, and that's it. It's the only thing I remember.
Yeah, well, in a few years, you'll be able to do that. We'll bring you in.
Now, how are your relations with the director of the show?
Yeah, they're strained right now. It's tough, because when Ann has to give me notes, she has to tiptoe, she has to, she doesn't want to offend me. but she's like, we have a little note, we have a little, we got through this. We're doing a reading in public on Saturday, and then we're supposed to start a workshop, but Jamie Brandley, who won the Humanitas Award for playwriting in Los Angeles before the pandemic a couple of years ago. I mean, she's a wonderful writer, and Beth has done a few of her plays, directed a few of her plays. She's already getting requests through her agent for this play, Sight Unseen.
Wow.
because, I mean, if you take a look at it, it's perfect for high schools can do it, colleges can do it, regional theater can do it, and you could do it on Broadway. It just depends on how you want to cast it. You get, you know, Sam Waterston in there playing Romeo and, you know, Jane Fonda playing Loretta. And you know, she plays Tybalt, too, you know, and then you get someone else playing Juliet, you know, you would have a hit show. So, and it's wonderful. And it's also for the people, you know, it's such a great play. Romeo and Juliet is so beautiful. And you have just the current stream of dialogue going, and then we're on stage and but soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east and Juliet is the sun. I mean, my God, my God. And Shakespeare never lived to be a senior. He passed away, I think, when he was like 56. Mm. And he left a legacy that is untouchable in the world, kind of like Isaac Newton, you know, kind of those untouchable legacies. Amazing. Amazing.
Well, and what's it like to be back on stage? I remember in the book, you talked about the rehearsal space as one of the holy places.
One of the holy places. It is. And, you know, yesterday, our holy space was our porch, our back porch with the helicopter, police helicopters going overhead and the wind. And I realized it isn't a conscious decision to make it a holy space, but through practice and years of doing it, the rehearsal space is a holy space where you have to find out what's true. That's what you have to do. It isn't finding out what's clever, and it isn't finding out where you're going to get a laugh, because you'll figure that out when you get an audience. But you have to find out what the truth of the scene is in that rehearsal space, and that's why it's holy. So it doesn't matter what kind of noise is there. That is your one mission.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. I sent you a message. I absolutely love your work in the HBO series Minx. What a wonderful show that is. Our friend Rich Sommer in it as well. Man, is that great.
Yeah, it was. I happened to be in the first episode, and we didn't know at the time, like doing Groundhog Day, you don't know at the time you're going to be in a hit show. You don't know. It's just all the same. So the thing I remember about Minx was that we were doing it at this very retro country club outside Los Angeles, outside Altadena, like up in the mountains, and everything was on an angle. This country club was on the side of a mountain, and so my trailer was on an angle to where when I'd lay on the bed in the trailer, I would roll off onto the floor and onto the other side of the trailer. When you go to the bathroom in the trailer, you know, if you're standing up at the toilet, you have to know trigonometry and geometry to, I mean, it's like, whoa, my goodness. You know, it's so dangerous. And then I was wearing retro clothes. I was wearing these 1980s clothes, which means, for the people out there who know sewing, it means you don't sew this stuff. Because if you do, it's going to fall apart. So I had to wear a male girdle. And I believe they call these a Manx. A Manx. So it went on my chest. It went over my chest, over my stomach, to where I could wear the sports jacket, the Manx. And as the costumer is putting it on me, you know, she said, well, go in private and put on the Manx, and I think you're going to find you love it. And what we're going to do is we'll put the jacket and the shirt on you and the tie. And if you want a Manx for your personal use, I can get you one at price. And I go, forget it. I don't need the Manx. I'm married already. I don't have to impress anyone anymore. You know, we've been married now. Gosh, Annie and I have been married, we figured 34 years.
Wow.
34 years. And gosh, how is it different being you know, you still walk around on tiptoes. You still don't want to insult someone after 34 years. We did do this one thing in the household that was a revelation for me last week. Is Ann said, because especially too with COVID, if I don't do something, she has to do it, and vice versa. You know, we don't have help. We don't go anywhere. We have to do the chores. And she says, is there anything I can do around the house that you have to do? What is it that you hate to do around the house? So this got me thinking of the things I hate to do around the house. And I do so many things around the house that are hateable. And I have to figure out what thing is it that I really hate more than anything else. I have to clean the rabbit cage every day, which is not nice. It's not a good thing to do because rabbit makes big mess. Clean the turtle bowl. Cleaning the turtle bowl is worse than cleaning the rabbit cage.
Why? That's,
well, the turtle eats worms, first of all. So if he doesn't eat all the worms, the leftover worms are in there. And sometimes those worms are still moving around.
Oh, dear.
And then the turtle, about once every 3 days, will have what you would call a turtle poop. And I don't know the physiology of this, but the turtle poop is almost as big as the turtle. You know, I don't know when and how it happens, but it's particularly nasty, and you have to clean this whole thing out. And what I do is I fill it in buckets of water and dump it in my neighbor's yard. And I feel like it's probably good fertilizer for them. But so I finally figured out what task I do that I hate more than any other that I would foist upon my wife of 34 years. And I waited for a particularly romantic moment. You know, we had just finished watching the fourth episode of The Office in a row, and it was time to like turn off the TV. You know, everyone's streaming The Office, and I understand why. So turn off the TV, and in bed I go, baby, I figured out what I hate the most to do around the house. And I said, I will give you a treat if you can guess what it is. And she could not. And she guessed the obvious. She guessed the turtle. She guessed the rabbit. No. She guessed me cleaning up the cat litter, all that. No. The number one thing I hate to do around the house is stir the peanut butter.
Oh.
When did I become the guy who has to open the new jar of Laura Scudder's nutty peanut butter and stir it? And let me tell you, I remember an age where you didn't have to stir peanut butter. You just open it up and you put it on the bread. Yeah. But now we went through this hippy-dippy period where suddenly, like, with an inch of oil on top of the peanut butter is going to be better. And so I wake up and let's say I want a little peanut butter on Ann's homemade bread, which is fabulous, the bread. And I have to spend my pre-coffee moments of the day stirring that peanut butter without sloshing the oil anywhere. So I said to Ann, if you could stir the peanut butter for me. And she goes, Stephen, I really think you're so much better at stirring the peanut butter than I am. I really think you do. It's one thing I've noticed, you do it so well. And I understand that is the method women my entire life have used, is the flattery method. But so far it's worked.
I don't have a great solution, but what I do for stirring the peanut butter is use a single beater on the electric mixer. So I just, because if you try to use two.
You put it in with your hand or with?
No, the electric mixer and just lower it in. If you try to use two, it won't fit into the jar. But if you use just one beater, it will go in the jar and you can use it in it. You do want to.
It doesn't like splatter all over the, it doesn't splatter all over the kitchen?
No, you just real slow and yeah, give it a shot. Because I hate stirring peanut butter too, but.
Okay, the next one, I did get a particularly large jar this time, so I didn't have to do it that often. And I found that the large jar was easier to stir than the smaller jars. So I will use the one beater method next time. And if it doesn't work, it's on your head, man. And you are going to be responsible for cleaning my kitchen.
You started out at one. Don't go in with a five setting. You're in trouble.
Now, what was Anne's least favorite job around the house?
Oh, God. I think, and it isn't that it's her least favorite because she loves it, but it's the most taxing. One of the things she's gotten into during the pandemic is making sourdough bread. And the thing about sourdough, it is not just a skill, but it is a life thing that you do. It requires time. It requires you being there when the bread is ready to go. So like something like 2 or 3 times a week, she has to feed the sourdough. She has to feed it. And then she has to coax it. Then she has to make loaves like about twice a week to use that sourdough and feed the other yeast going. And so it's this very time-consuming thing. And you have to heat the oven up to 500 degrees. And she got this oven thing, this container, this cast iron skillet from Germany that has a top on it. And you put it in the oven at 500 degrees for a long time. And then you pull it out and she wears these super asbestos mitts to put the sourdough in there, and you do it for 20 minutes by the clock. Then you pull it out and then you take it out of that cast iron thing and put it back in the oven for another 20 minutes and then it's done. And then it's done. And it has to be perfect and it has to happen. That's just so time consuming for her. So that's what she loses sleep over.
That's like science. That's too much.
That's like a third world problem when you're losing sleep over making your bread.
Is being a granddad still the most wonderful thing in the world?
Yeah, it's being a granddad is pretty great. Dior has gotten to be a real master of the smackdown. And now, people, Dior is about to become 2. She will become 2 at the end of June. And so she is no longer a bald baby. She now has hair on her head, you know, just beautiful hair growing on her head. So 2 days ago, she comes up to me and starts pulling on the hair on her head, like, and fluffing it and doing this. Then she looks at me and points at my bald head and shrugs like, too bad. Too bad. You know, I don't know what happened to you, but I'm fine.
Look what I can do.
Yeah. So she's a master of the smackdown. She loves the garden. She loves feeding the squirrels. It's just, and I was trying to think yesterday, what is it? Because I hear this all over the place now. We may have talked about it before, you know, about the joys of grandparentdom versus like when we were kids, cars. You know, when we were kids, right. I remember with Mark Dombrowski in library class, just looking at magazines, Road and Track. Oh, I want a 405. Well, what's 4? Oh, that's 405. So that's big engine. Well, I want a 445. You know, we're all talking about engines. I want this car. I want this car. And I've been driving my whole life and I hate it. Nobody in school said being a grandparent is the greatest thing in your life. If you could hang around for that. And so I was trying to think of yesterday during rehearsal when I was waiting for my lines to come up and for Truth to enter into the arena of the holy arena. I'm thinking like, what is it about Dior and about being a grandparent that's so transcendent? And I thought, you know, in a very selfish way, it is an affirmation of life. It's an affirmation that what you did was something right, that you fell in love, you got married, and you two together decided to have a child, that life was good enough to continue the cycle. And then that child felt that his life or her life was good enough for them to carry the cycle on and have a child. And somehow it affirms all of the mistakes, everything you've done in your life, where you're driving off the road here, there, and everywhere, you know, somehow, some way, what I did was right because life is saying, yes, Stephen, you get this joy at the end of your life, at the tail end of your story. You get this special joy of seeing that it was all worthwhile. And And that is, and especially, you know, with someone like Dior that's so full of humor and so full of, she loves music and she loves everything I love. How did that happen? I guess because those were the things I showed her.
Yeah.
You know, and so it becomes an affirmation of the things I knew growing up. It's the most splendid thing I could possibly imagine.
I may not get to experience that because I came to fatherhood so late in life, being 63, almost 64 with an 8-year-old now.
Congratulations.
But I get some of that. And, you know, we were talking about something the other day and I said to him, I mentioned something about when I'm old. And he looked at me and said, you're old now.
King of the smackdown.
Yes. And then just this little sly grin came to his face. And I realized, this is only the beginning. I've got to put up with this for the rest of my natural life.
I have always felt, why is it that humor is so intoxicating? I think because it is a form of courage. I think we're not cavemen anymore. We don't want to go out and kill the saber-toothed tigers, but we can go up to somebody and go, kill a saber tooth today. No, I got something better to do, man. I'm going to sit back here and sip on my piña colada. You know, and the idea of telling a joke or making someone laugh or smile or smacking them down is just a form of courage. Sometimes not a good form of courage, but a form of courage.
Now, you've done so much in your career, Steve. Have you ever done stand-up?
Oh, God, no. No, the thing is, I'm too story-oriented. I find the people who do stand-ups, if you take a look at really good ones like Jerry Seinfeld or Stephen Wright, Gary Shandling, really great, great, great stand-ups, a lot of times their routines are made up of what I would call a lot of act ones. You know, they would begin a story and they do this story thing, but the story really doesn't grow or develop or go into anything. And I've always been kind of enamored of the surprising story that starts at one place and goes to another. And it's hard to just fill all that up with jokes. I try sometimes, like in the podcast, I try to have, some of them are funny, where they are naturally funny. But I do like, again, this isn't stand-up, but I'd like the idea of when I got off of the airplane and there was the information man at the airport wearing his T-shirt and his hat, a senior citizen, T-shirt, hat, and had the candy canes on the table. And I said, so I decided I had time in between flights, you know. So I'm just curious, where does my Delta flight leave? And he goes, I have no information. I said, what? You're information man. He said, well, I'm information man, but they don't let me have information anymore. I said, why don't they let you have information anymore? He said, well, because at the airport, the information changes so rapidly. I was giving the people the wrong information too much. So they said, it's best you just hand out candy canes and you don't give out any information. But what information do you need? And I said, well, I'm scared to ask you now with that, you know, the fact that you give out wrong information, but I'm looking for this Delta flight and I just don't know where that gate is. And he says, I'm going to try to find you some information. And he went into the pilot's lounge and he brought a pilot out Delta pilot. And he goes, ask him your question. So I said, where does my flight? He says, well, it's a good thing that the information man came and got me because we've had a lot of trouble with that gate. And we don't do that gate at the Delta thing anymore. Now we do that at United. And so you're actually in the wrong terminal. You're going to have to go outside. You're going to have to walk down to two more terminals, go back in the building and go back out to this gate. That's where your flight's going to leave from. And I looked at the information man and I said, do you know I never would have found my flight if you didn't get me that information? You are not only the information man, as far as I'm concerned, you're the best information man I've ever met at an airport. And I enjoy stories like that, that have beginning, middle, and ends, and they're just nuts on the surface of them. They're crazy, you know, but you would never do that as a stand-up because stand-ups, you got to have a joke like every 5 seconds or something, you know, like you watch Jerry Seinfeld. He's just hilarious.
Right. Will there be any more Tobolowsky files in our future?
Yeah, I've written some actually. And because of the intensity of Dior time, I talked to David Chen and probably I will start recording them again probably within the next month or two. Oh, I'll start recording them again and then getting them to David. He'll add his parts and edit them, and then we'll start putting them on. So hopefully they will be on before the end of the year.
That's wonderful.
We'll have some as a Christmas present.
Oh, that's great. Now, I see the Goldbergs got renewed for a 10th season, but Adam has graduated. What does that mean for Principal Ball?
Yeah, well, you know, I would be worried, but the final, I got to say, the people at the Goldbergs are kind of magnificent in the way they keep the ball in the air. It's not enough to have someone great like Wendy McClendon Covey, you know, leading the show and all the wonderful cast in the show. It's and the funny writing of the show, but you have to deal with crises. You have to deal with the fact of things going off the track, like, you know, George Segal passing away, like Jeff Garlin leaving the show. You have to deal with these major hiccups. Kids are going to graduate from school, but they have come up with some very compelling cliffhangers at the end of this season to where Wendy is going to have a more permanent position at the school.
Good.
Hello. That means she's going to be working with me and she's going to be working with Tim Meadows. So the three of us hopefully are going to be working. We'll see. Maybe fired. And
your scenes with Wendy are just gold.
Oh, Wendy and I just love working together. We love doing. And also there is the eldest daughter, Haley Goldberg, is coming back, and she ends up, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, she's going to end up getting a job at the school too.
Oh, wonderful.
And there are a few other absolutely lovely plot developments that are going to make it a very rich season as well. But that is, it's amazing. Boy, it is like you spend your whole lifetime dodging the bullets. And in the beginning of your life, you have a lot of respect for the bullets. But later in your life, man, you have a lot of respect for the dodging.
Well, you have been in so many wonderful series in recent years, and you know, depending on your perspective, you could say, "Well, gosh, you know, Stephen is so lucky to keep getting these great parts." But at some point, I think you got to look at it from the other direction and say, "I think it's because people who make good television shows and films want Stephen involved because he's going to add even more to it and make them better."
Well, that's the theory. I think another thing that happens is there's a practical idea too. I was at Sony Pictures, the head of Sony approved me as a network approval when I did, I think, Silicon Valley. I'm thinking that may have been Silicon Valley, may have been the first where they go like, we give Stephen Tobolowsky approval as a network for Sony to be on a show. And then the Goldbergs, or maybe it was the Goldbergs was for, one of the two was the first. And then they said, well, he already has network approval. So we'll have Stephen here do this. And then from the Goldbergs come Schooled, which is the same group. Well, we have Stephen, so we'll just move him over to that series. And then with One Day at a Time, I auditioned for Norman Lear, which was a wonderful experience. To meet him was such a wonderful experience. And it was one of those times where I wasn't nervous at all to go in on an audition. I just felt so privileged to meet Norman. So happy and to share with him. I mean, he didn't know the background story that the first job I got in Los Angeles was his casting director, Jane Murray. I wrote they have Backstage, and they have all these little magazines back then where they had notice for auditions for newbies out there. And Jane Murray was casting director of Mary Hartman, all of Norman shows. And I wrote her a letter. They had her casting address in the magazine. I wrote, "Hello, my name is Stephen Tobolowsky. I'm from Dallas, Texas. I have loved Mr. Lear shows for years and anything I could possibly do." And Jane Murray called me. She called me. She's one of the few people on earth that called me like a couple days later. She said, "This is Jane Murray. Would you like to be on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman?" And I go, "Yes, ma'am." She says, "Well, you'll be an extra. You'll come in. You'll work on Thursday." I go, "Thank you so much." So I was able to tell Norman that my first job was on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. And the first TV show I ever saw was One Day at a Time, because Kay Callan, a girl from Oak Cliff, Texas, where I was born and went to school, made it. And she made it and was a recurring character on the original One Day at a Time with Bonnie Franklin. And so she invited me when I came out, and I met Norman then. And I said, "You know, the first show I did was with Jane Murray. The first show I ever saw was One Day at a Time. And it's such a privilege to meet you. You know, you've made my life so much better, and I appreciate it." And then I got the part. And one of the reasons I got the part was I'm auditioning at Sony. Norman certainly said yes, but I didn't need Sony's approval because I already had it. So there is the practicality. And another thing, which I will give this advice to all the young people out there that are listening in Maine, one of the most important things you could do in show business to work: be on time. Be on time. I have seen so many young performers on their first job get fired on the spot because they were 10 minutes late. It's like, don't be late, and you already have your foot in the door.
I had a director tell a group of us years ago doing a regional theater show, "I look at the three A's," he said, "ability, affability, and availability." And I assume you all have ability, but I'm looking for the other two. Can you show up on time? Can you play well with others? Then I'll want to work with you.
Right. If you're one of the people that shows up late, if you're one of the people that causes problems on the set, is difficult, it just, a production has already stripped itself down, especially with COVID, to handle all the difficulties of a day without you being one of the difficulties of the day. You know, they require you to be ready to work, like Wendy and I. I told this story, I think, last time I was on your show, how we were doing one comedy scene at the end of the day, Wendy and I, and then someone comes on, there's been a COVID break on set, you know, everybody leave. You know, we'll tell you what's going on. And so we're scared to death. We go out of the studio. We're waiting at sundown. We've been working 13 hours. And they said, "Okay, someone was on the set. We've done contact tracing. You're safe. We'll write you. We'll tell you what's going to happen in the morning, what we're doing in the morning." And then I get an email that night saying, "You and Wendy are safe. You and Wendy were not near anyone who had COVID. We will finish your scene in the morning." And so we did half of a comic scene after 13 hours of work all day, a huge COVID scare, afraid to go to sleep, not knowing what our status is going to be. And then we have a 6 a.m. call in the morning to finish the comedy scene. And it is so difficult to do that. You can't practice that in college. You can't practice that in acting school. But what you can do is always be ready. And so when they call you, you're ready to work.
Good advice for anything in life. Stephen, it's wonderful to catch up with you as always. Look forward to hearing more about the Romeo and Juliet Senior Citizens Project as well.
It's a killer. It is just a killer. I can't wait.
Well, we wish you much success with that. Thanks, as always, for making time for us. Say hi to Ann, and we'll visit with you again before too long.
You got it. Thank you so much, Rich.